Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. Today, we'll be talking about immigrant raids happening across the nation that are striking fear into immigrant communities and what you should know if an ICE agent comes to your door. Then we'll have an important weather warning about a storm hitting our region that could be the worst in a decade or more. You'll hear about the resignation of President Trump's National Security Advisor and why some members of Congress are calling for a full investigation into the Trump administration's ties to Russia. Plus, hear how a national resistance movement to the Trump agenda is affecting members of Congress and at least one cabinet official. Locally, hear why a prominent labor leader in San Diego is facing calls to resign. Learn about Lemon Grove's recent actions on marijuana dispensaries, and hear why the crash of a student flight out of Gillespie Field is renewing citizens' concerns about public safety. Our newsmaker interview today is Dr. Patrick Sullivan, the anesthesiologist who blew the whistle on cameras in the Women's Center operating rooms at Grossmont Hospital. Now he's suing the hospital, and you'll hear why on today's show. Then on Destination East County, we'll have all the top festivals and events coming up, from a Latin music concert to Black History Month commemorations to a St. Patrick's Day run across East County, where participants will be wearing the green. Stay tuned for all these stories and more on today's edition of the East County Magazine show on KNSJ, where East County matters.
Immigration raids in cities across the nation are striking fear among immigrant communities. Although the Trump administration has claimed the recent sweeps are routine, some people picked up and deported have no criminal backgrounds, belying President Donald Trump's post-election promise to focus on criminals. In Arizona, a mother with two children born in America was deported, prompting protest and tearful separation from her children and her husband. Guadalupe Garcia de Reyes, 35, came to the U.S. at age 14 and has lived here for 21 years. She has no criminal history other than being picked up in an immigration raid at her workplace in 2008 with false papers to get the job. She's checked in with immigration and customs officials regularly as required ever since, but she was deemed a low priority for deportation until now. It is unclear whether the sweeps in multiple states, including California, were due to Trump's executive order signed January 25th. The order authorizes deportations not only for convicted criminals, but far more broadly, also for anyone who is accused of a crime or has committed acts that constitute a chargeable offense. In short, merely accusing someone of a crime, even falsely, could lead to deportation. The order also allows deportation of anyone who misrepresented information on government applications or in interviews with officials. In addition, undocumented immigrants who receive public benefits to which they were not entitled can be deported. So can anyone with a final order for removal, even if it was later canceled. In addition, anyone deemed to pose a risk to public safety or national security can be deported. Those categories are broad enough to permit the deportation of millions of people. That could have a big impact locally. In San Diego, 22% of all residents are undocumented immigrants, or about 170,000 people, according to a Pew Research study. Impacts could be huge on sectors including the economy, tourism business, agriculture, housing, and schools. Senator Feinstein has issued a statement harshly criticizing the sweeps. The California Democrat says, "These reports show the serious consequences of the president's executive order, which allows all undocumented immigrants to be characterized as criminals and requires increased enforcement in communities rather than prioritizing dangerous criminals." Homeland Security Chief John Kelly, speaking at San Ysidro last Friday, promised to work with law enforcement and officials but repeated Trump's threat to withhold federal funds for communities that don't cooperate with deportation efforts. San Diego Police Chief Shelley Zimmerman has voiced concerns that crime victims may not report crimes if they fear deportation by coming forward, a situation that could prevent arrest of violent criminals preying on not only immigrants but others in the community. On social media, some criticized the raids, while others voiced support. One comment posted on a San Diego Union-Tribune story urged readers to report anyone offering to help an undocumented immigrant, noting that it is a crime to aid illegal aliens. Others posted images of raids and stores of those impacted using the hashtag #ICERaids on Twitter. The American Friends Service Committee is urging people to take action. The group has also published a bilingual booklet on rights that immigrants should know, which you can find at afsc.org. The American Civil Liberties Union offers this advice to undocumented individuals. If an ICE agent shows up at your door, don't open it and stay calm. You have rights. Ask why they are there and ask for an interpreter if you need one. If they ask to enter, ask if they have a warrant signed by a judge, and if so, ask to see it through a window or slipped under a door. If they do not have a warrant signed by a judge, you can refuse to let them in and ask them to leave any information at your door. Note, an ICE administrative warrant does not allow them to enter your home without consent. If they force their way in, don't resist and tell everyone in the home to remain silent. If you are arrested, stay silent and don't sign anything until you speak to a lawyer. Reporting on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Gene Carpenter.
This is John Fisteer with an important weather alert. The National Weather Service warns that a storm system due to hit our region Friday and Saturday could be as severe as the January downpours, with additional hazards. The forecast warns that a tornado could strike coastal or inland San Diego County on Saturday. Tornadoes are rare in our region, and though not on the massive scale of tornadoes in the Midwest, can cause serious damage. The forecast also includes lightning on beaches starting Friday, with waterspouts offshore forecast on Saturday. Hazardous marine conditions will occur, with near gale force winds and rough seas. Damaging surf up to 15 feet could also cause coastal flooding. Thunderstorms are also forecast in inland areas of San Diego County, along with small hail, damaging winds, and heavy rains. Flash floods in low-lying water crossings and river flooding could occur, as well as mudslides, particularly in recently burned areas. Heavy snow is forecast above 5,000 feet, with the snow level dropping to 4,500 feet by Saturday. Above 6,000 feet, up to 2 feet of new snow may fall, much to the delight of skiers at Southern California resorts. Mountain areas in our region are also expected to have dense fog. Avoid travel if possible. If you are on the road, check traffic reports for road closures. Watch for toppled trees and power lines as rainfall saturates the grounds and heavy winds sweep in with gusts up to 65 miles per hour.
The resignation of National Security Advisor Michael Flynn this week raises disturbing questions. First, questions about Flynn's own actions. Why did Flynn suggest to Russia's ambassador that the Trump administration might lift sanctions over Russia's incursion into the Ukraine weeks before Trump took office? Why did Flynn lie to Vice President Pence and claim that he never discussed sanctions with the Russian representative? Did Flynn violate the Logan Act, which prohibits private citizens from engaging in foreign policy, since his talks with Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak occurred before Flynn was appointed National Security Advisor? As for the president himself, more questions are swirling. Why did President Trump ignore a warning weeks ago from Acting Attorney General Sally Yates that Flynn could be subject to blackmail by Russia for his actions, which were reportedly confirmed in intercepted communications? Why did Trump appoint Flynn as National Security Advisor knowing that he might be compromised? Since Trump reportedly knew about the controversy at least 2 weeks before Vice President Pence was informed. Why has Trump repeatedly praised Russian dictator Vladimir Putin? Are British intelligence claims that the Russians have compromising information on Trump true? Flynn repeatedly pushed for close ties with Russia, a departure from longstanding U.S. policy since the Cold War era. In his resignation letter, he said that he inadvertently briefed Vice President Pence with incomplete information and said he has apologized to the President and Vice President. Trump, in characteristic fashion, responded to the controversy on Twitter. He did not address the concerns over Flynn or Russian blackmail at first. Instead, he tweeted, "The real story here is why are there so many illegal leaks coming out of Washington? Will these leaks be happening as ideal on North Korea?" White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer said the president asked for Flynn's resignation due to an evolving and eroding level of trust, the BBC reports. Trump aide Kellyanne Conway has said it was misleading the vice president that made the situation unsustainable, and not an illegal violation, according to her. But some members of Congress are concerned about not only Flynn, but Trump's odd history of surrounding himself with people tied to Russia, and the president's own Russian entanglements. During Trump's campaign, his campaign manager, Paul Manafort, previously worked for a pro-Russian Ukrainian political party. He resigned from the Trump campaign amid revelations that he had previously set up a slush fund with money from Russian oligarchs to loot Ukrainian assets and elect Viktor Yanukovych, who was pro-Putin, the New York Times reports. A British intelligence officer recently prepared a dossier that was provided to key U.S. officials recently, and it alleged that Russia had compromising information on Trump ranging from business dealings in Russia to sexual escapades with prostitutes. Trump has flatly denied all of this. However, some of the non-salacious portions have been affirmed by other intelligence sources, The Guardian and other media reports. Some Republicans are now joining with Democrats to call for serious probes of Trump and his team's Kremlin ties. Senator Roy Blunt, a Republican member of the Senate Intelligence Committee, and Texas Senator John Cornyn, the second highest-ranking Senate Republican leader, have broken with their party and called for a full investigation into any alleged connections between President Trump himself and Russian officials. But the chairman of that Senate Intelligence Committee, Republican David Nunes, has thus far refused to investigate the Trump administration's Russian ties. Instead, he declared he intends to pursue an investigation focused against leakers in the White House. Democratic Representatives John Conyers of Michigan and Elijah Cummings of Maryland have both asked for a classified briefing from the Department of Justice and the FBI. Congresswoman Susan Davis, a San Diego Democrat whose district includes part of East County, is calling for a full investigation into Russian influences on the Trump administration. Congresswoman Davis states, "The resignation of Michael Flynn underscores the increasing and disturbing potential of Russia's grip on the White House. It's another instance of someone in the administration, the other being the president himself, who could potentially be subject to blackmail by the Russian government." Davis adds that Congress has a responsibility to follow all the threads to reveal what this means to our national security and our democracy. She concludes, "There needs to be an outside, bipartisan, and independent investigation into Russian influence in the White House and the election." She called for the FBI to step up its investigation into the financial and personal connections of the president to Russia. Senator Elizabeth Warren, a Democrat from Massachusetts, had this to say on Twitter, "This isn't a game. Reports say the Russians conducted a series of successful cyber attacks on our elections to help elect Donald Trump. Reports say our own intelligence agencies have corroborated parts of a dossier alleging that Russia has compromising information about Donald Trump. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has close ties to Putin. Commerce Secretary nominee Wilbur Ross has close financial ties to Putin buddies," she adds. Warren continued, "Donald Trump is still making money overseas and may have financial ties to Russia. Nobody knows, since he still won't release his taxes. President Trump owes the American people a full account of his administration's dealing with Russia both before and after the election." And then Warren asked these tough questions. When did the White House know that Flynn lied? What other contacts with Russia occurred during the campaign? Who knew what? Who approved what? Congress must pull its head out of the sand and launch a real, bipartisan, transparent inquiry into Russia. Our national security is at stake, Warren concludes. Dan Rather, longtime news anchorman for CBS News, recently stated on his Facebook page, News and Guts, that he believes scandals involving Trump's Russian ties could ultimately prove to be bigger than Watergate, the scandal that brought down the Nixon administration. Flynn's resignation leaves retired General Keith Kellogg, former chief of staff of the White House National Security Council, as the acting National Security Advisor. Reuters reports that Trump is considering three potential appointees to permanently fill the vacancy, including Kellogg. The others are retired General David Petraeus, who is also former director of the CIA, and Robert Harward, former deputy commander of U.S. Central Command. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
The past week has been tough for some Republican congressional members backing the Trump agenda, as well as for a cabinet appointee. They've been dogged by vocal protests at airports, town hall meetings, schools, and even outside their own homes. Senate leader Mitch McConnell cut off Senator Elizabeth Warren's testimony during confirmation hearings on Jeff Sessions as Attorney General. McConnell refused to allow Warren to read a letter from Martin Luther King's widow opposing Sessions' nomination. Arriving back in his Kentucky district, McConnell first fled from protesters at the airport tarmac, only to find a large crowd outside his home, where protesters read Coretta Scott King's letter out loud. Utah Congressman Jeff Chaffetz drew a crowd of 1,000 people at a town hall in Salt Lake City, where constituents were booing and shouting, "Do your job!" The crowd voiced anger over his bill to sell off public lands and his refusal to investigate President Trump's business conflicts of interest as chair of the House Oversight Committee. In California, police had to escort Republican Congressman Tom McClintock out of his town hall in Roseville. He was put on the defensive for his support of Trump's travel ban on immigrants from Muslim nations and for his support of repealing Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act. McClintock faced hundreds of irate constituents chanting, "Vote him out!" In Washington, protesters temporarily blocked Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos from entering a public school. Protesters taunted DeVos for giving money to senators who confirmed her for the position, shouting, "Shame, shame, shame." In Tennessee, Republican Congresswoman Diane Black also faced a hostile audience. When a teacher stood to ask that the Affordable Care Act be fixed, not repealed, the crowd cheered. In New York, hundreds protested in a march outside Goldman Sachs headquarters to oppose Wall Street appointees in Trump's administration and Wall Street's influence in rolling back reforms that protected consumers from predatory lending practices, CNBC reports. On February 17th, some activists are organizing a national general strike to oppose Trump administration policies. The national strike is drawing international media attention. Participants in the national strike plan to walk off from jobs, schools, and homes, joining fellow citizens in the streets in a peaceful display of resistance. Strike participants say that they will refuse to shop or otherwise participate in what they view as a rigged economy. For more information on the national strike, you can visit strikefordemocracy.com with the number 4. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Fistier.
Two lawsuits have been filed against San Diego leader Mickey Kasparian, president of the San Diego Imperial County's Labor Council and president of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union Local 135. Though the cases have not been heard in court, some prominent San Diegans are calling on Kasparian to resign. Kasparian has denied all charges, according to the Reader. The most serious allegations are in a suit filed by former clerk Isabel Vasquez, who claims Kasparian threatened to fire her if she refused to provide sexual favors. In a second suit, a female union organizer says Kasparian retaliated against her for siding with a political rival. A third employee filed a discrimination claim, but her grievance against Local 135 was dismissed as lacking merit. The union says she was fired for falsifying documents, destroying union property, and insubordination. A letter signed by over 36 prominent Democrats sent to union and labor council leaders, as well as the County Democratic Party, calls on Kasparian to resign. Alternatively, the letter asked the labor organizations to put him on administrative leave while conducting a prompt, independent investigation into the claims that women are suffering or have suffered sexual harassment, retaliation, and bullying in the workplace at the bequest of Mr. Kasparian. The letter also urged that steps be taken to protect existing employees and called on the Democratic Party to consider replacing Kasparian as a delegate to the party's State Central Committee, even though he has not been found guilty of any wrongdoing thus far. Signers of the letter include Councilman David Alvarez, former Assemblymember Lori Saldana, and other local elected officials and activists. Former Councilmember Donna Fry, who led efforts to push former Mayor Bob Filner to resign amid sexual harassment allegations, has also called on Kasparian to step down. But the Labor Council's Secretary-Treasurer, Dale Kelly Bankhead, says she has faith in the court system, adding, "No internal Labor Council investigation could do a better job." UFCW's Local 135 is also standing by Kasparian. Their letter voices disappointments in critics who, quote, "choose to ignore the facts or turn the backs on our members." We may be living in bizarre times, but facts still matter. Lawsuits are not truth, especially when they are filed by those who have failed to do their job. The Union Local's letter concludes, "We will not be bullied into ignoring the needs of our members or what our mission is," adding, "We are here to serve our members, and that is what Mickey and all of us have always done." Reporting on KNSJ, this is Gene Carpenter.
A small plane registered to the American Aviation Academy Flight School at Gillespie Field crashed Sunday onto a mountainside in Ramona, killing 21-year-old Shara Noon. A student pilot from Bangladesh, Noor, was in the back seat of the Cessna and was impaled by a tree on impact. Another student and the flight instructor survived, climbing uphill and using their cell phones to call for help. The sheriff's helicopter and deputies from the Ramona substation found the crash and helped rescue the two survivors, who were transported to a local hospital with minor injuries. This is not the first time a flight from a Gillespie flight school has crashed. At least two flight school planes have fallen into nearby neighborhoods in the past couple of years. Robert German, with Citizens Against Gillespie Expansion, has been a vocal critic of flight schools at Gillespie Field in El Cajon. "We are only 1.5 months into 2017, and Gillespie already has a fatality by a flight school," he says, noting that Gillespie wants to increase the number of students training at its flight schools and also wants to start training air traffic controllers. Gillespie wants to be an instrumented rated airport, which means aircraft pilot training will be taken off and landing at all times of the day and night in bad weather. "Is this smart for an airport surrounded by mountains and hills?" asked Germain, noting that the mountains surrounding Gillespie are heavily populated. Germain asked that the owner of the flight school involved in the crash last weekend recently spoke to a group of citizens worried about low-flying aircraft over the homes and told them, "If they don't know the dangers, they should move." Germain wants to know how many hours of instruction time the instructor had and whether maneuvers made were appropriate given the altitude, terrain, power of the aircraft with three people aboard. The cause of the crash will be determined by an investigation conducted by the Federal Aviation Administration. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Rebecca Williamson.
Last November, Lemon Grove voters approved Measure V, allowing for sale of medical marijuana in Lemon Grove. Dispensaries will be allowed in certain sections of the city with a conditional use permit. In the same election, California voters approved recreational marijuana. That measure included a clause that allows municipalities to ban such sales in their jurisdictions. So, last week, the Lemon Grove City Council unanimously agreed to update its municipal code per staff's recommendation and the election results to authorize medical marijuana sales, and also officially banning the sale of recreational marijuana within Lemon Grove. Dana Stevens from Citizens Against Substance Abuse praised the council for closing dispensaries in the past, adding, "Thank you for your leadership." A spokesperson from San Diegans for Safe Neighborhoods testified that the need for medical marijuana is limited, and thus, the number of dispensaries should be very few. She also asked for limits on advertising and for council to regulate edibles. Barbara Gordon, an advisor for a youth group, said students are concerned that dispensaries will increase drug use by their peers. "Public safety needs to be the council's primary concern," she said, and asked for the community to have more input. Councilmember Jennifer Mendoza assured that the regulations will be refined at future council meetings and encouraged concerned citizens to come back before the council or review minutes on the council website to stay informed on the progress of the marijuana clinic regulations. Reporting for East County Magazine, this is Jonathan Goetz.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice, recording at our studio in East County. Today, my very special guest is Dr. Patrick Sullivan, who was an anesthesiologist at Grossmont Hospital, Sharp Grossmont Hospital in La Mesa, for over 25 years. He's the former head of anesthesiology there, and now he is suing the hospital, alleging that he was harassed into resigning after blowing the whistle when he found secret videotaping of female patients in the operating room. Patrick, welcome to the show today.
Thank you.
Let's start, if you could, by just telling us a little bit about your own background as an anesthesiologist. I understand that you had trained at some very prestigious institutions.
Yeah, well, I started out, I got my undergraduate degree from the University of Wisconsin in Madison, Wisconsin, and then I went from there to the Medical College of Wisconsin, where I got my MD degree. That was in Milwaukee. It was formerly the Marquette University School of Medicine. Then I did my year of internship in Denver, Colorado, at Presbyterian St. Luke's Medical Center, and from there...
You had clerkships at Harvard and the Mayo Clinic, some really prestigious
places. My senior year of medical school, I did many away rotations. I did about 3 months at the Massachusetts General Hospital with Harvard Medical School. I did a month at the Mayo Clinic. I really enjoyed my time there.
And then you came here and you did residency training at the University of California, San Diego, UCSD, before joining Sharp Grossmont Hospital.
Correct.
So you were there for a lot of years. Obviously, you had a very good reputation as somebody who headed up anesthesiology at one point. And then you made this startling discovery. Tell us how and when you found out that there were cameras in the operating room.
Well, one night I was doing a C-section, and it was kind of a long one, and I just was sitting there. The patient was stable, and I was sitting there, and I noticed that the HP emblem, the round HP emblem on the top of the rim of the computer monitor, had been replaced with a small hole that looked like a lens. And I took a look at it, and I said, this has got to be a microphone or a camera or something, but I couldn't imagine that they would be doing that. Then later on, I went into the other two operating rooms and found, in the women's center, and found similar cameras there.
So what did you do?
Well, I believe it was the next day. I ran into the women's center director in the hallway, and I said, by the way, you don't have cameras in the rims of our anesthesia computer monitors, do you? And she, I think, said, I'm not at liberty to discuss any of that, and that was that.
And this is a really serious issue, because we're talking about privacy violations of, I don't know how many women, hundreds, thousands, that were videotaped without their consent. In many cases, these, you know, without their clothes on, really the most intimate kind of photographs that you can have. And these were reviewed by hospital security. Ostensibly, the hospital was trying to prove that a doctor, an anesthesiologist, not you, but a different one on staff, was suspected of stealing drugs, according to the hospital. And so they felt that was justification to compromise the privacy of these many, many women, not only security personnel, but in some cases, state regulators saw these tapes, and even some of them were mistakenly disclosed to the attorney of that doctor, who also later filed suit against them. So when you tried to complain about this and you went up to the ladder, what happened?
Well, nothing. However, once we realized these actually were cameras, I mean, I think it took us, you know, a week or two to figure out that they were, we would try to protect our patients by putting a piece of tape over the lens every time we would do a case there, yeah, so that it couldn't film them. But by the time we discovered the cameras, they had already been there 9 or 10 months. We know that now in retrospect. At the time, we didn't know how long they had been there, but they had actually been there 9 to 10 months. And it's just not something you look for. When you're there and you've got multiple monitors mm-hmm. to look at while you're taking care of a patient, you know, you're focusing on the screen, and you don't
yeah.
notice that a little round HP emblem was replaced with a hole with
so
a lens.
This sparked outrage in the community, of course, when this came out. And I understand that there's been at least one, you were telling me today, two class action lawsuits now, is that right, that have been filed by women over this, over the violation of privacy.
Yeah, there are two. One was filed last May. The other was filed this past January, last month. They allege numerous violations of patient privacy by Sharp, breach of patient confidentiality.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the complaint, they even accuse Sharp of distribution of pornography.
Wow. Yeah, so those are really serious allegations. Now, at some point, they finally took the cameras out of the hospital or out of the operating rooms.
Well, it was pointless to keep them there because we discovered them, I believe, in March of 2013, and by the time the summer rolled around, every anesthesiologist was putting tape over them, so mm-hmm. it was not, you know, it was
yeah.
not a secret anymore. That was in the summer of 2013.
And then you thought they were gone. Maybe they were, and then...
No, they were gone. I mean, at least from that location, they were gone.
Mm-hmm.
They were not in the rims of computer monitors until I saw them again in January of 2016.
Yeah, so tell us about that. You must have been really surprised to see computers that appeared to have cameras in them again.
Well, I was, and so I told the chief of staff, Dr. Orr, that if they were videotaping people, that they shouldn't be doing that, and I had also heard in a meeting that I attended that they planned on putting cameras in the new Heart and Vascular Center that is
really?
Was built there, and is, if it hasn't opened yet, it's close to opening, and that's wrong and that shouldn't be done.
Yeah, it seems like at least the patients should be.
He said he would look into it and never got back to me.
So, to backtrack for a moment, I do want to add that when the news about these cameras first came out and these, you know, even before the suits got filed, Sharp Grossmont did apologize for inadvertently turning videos over. And as we say, they took the cameras out at least for a while. Now, in response to your claims that you found new cameras again, the hospital came out about the 2016 allegations, and they're denying that part of it. They are saying that they had purchased laptop computers that came with cameras installed, but that they never activated the software in those cameras. So what do you have to say about that?
Well, I don't have any proof that they were rolling.
Were they laptop computers?
No, they were not laptop computers, and that's one of the things that Sharp has claimed since this lawsuit came out, is that they were in laptop computers, and everybody knows that laptop computers have a camera in the rim. We were never going to use them, so what's the big deal?
Interesting. But, so they really haven't addressed the allegation that they had them in desktop computers.
They were not in laptop computers. I don't know how Sharp can say that. They were clearly in desktop computer rims. And if you walk through Sharp Grossmont Hospital, you will find lots of other desktop computer rims that do not have cameras, except in the operating rooms.
Okay, so a little bit more background on this, listeners. The reason, you may be wondering why the hospital would put these cameras in there to begin with, the reason why they ostensibly did this was because they said they were tipped off that a doctor was stealing drugs, which of course could be a very serious allegation if that was true. And the doctor that they accused of this, a fellow named Dr. Adam Doran, there was a complaint filed, but it was eventually dropped. In other words, no wrongdoing against him was found by the state of California. And that's largely because other doctors came forward to explain the circumstances. None of these drugs went out of the hospital. There was no evidence that he was using these. Dr. Sullivan, can you tell us what was going on with these drugs? Why would a doctor, an anesthesiologist, be pocketing drugs at the hospital?
Because there was a national propofol shortage, and Grossman Hospital could not procure enough propofol to properly stock all the anesthesia carts. So when anesthesiologists would run out of it in the main operating room and other areas of the hospital, they would come to the women's center, which oftentimes was the only repository of propofol in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And so lots of anesthesiologists were doing it.
They were basically stashing it away for use later when they would have an emergency.
Or taking it for immediate patient use. I mean, there were times when I would be in the main OR and the patient would literally be on the table and there was no propofol in the cart to put the patient to sleep.
Wow. Shocking. So Dr. Doran, I understand, some of those videos showed him, you know, not only taking drugs and putting them in his pocket, but also taking them out of his pocket and putting them back on anesthesia carts and other parts of the hospital.
Well, that's exactly right. Sharp was very forthcoming with the videos that showed him taking the propofol, but they also had videos of him putting the propofol back, but yet continued to prosecute him as an alleged propofol thief for 3.5 years, making his life, you know, a living hell.
I'm wondering if all the doctors were doing this, or multiples, why he was singled out. I've heard that he had been a whistleblower at one point himself prior to that.
Well, I know that in the spring of 2013, he did report some violations in the Grossman Hospital Women's Center to the Joint Commission.
Do we know how that was resolved? Was it found that his complaints were valid, do we know, or not?
I can't remember exactly. I know that, you know, the hospital usually doesn't share stuff like that with the results of an inspection necessarily with the entire hospital staff.
Okay. So we don't know the outcome, but we do know that he had filed a complaint, and I know that he has claimed that he thought he was maybe retaliated against. Whether that's true or not, we don't know.
Right. And another thing is that he was also the medical director at the Sharp Grossman Surgery Center, which is right down the hill.
Yeah.
Perhaps there was some retaliation from his years as in that position as well.
Now, you have alleged other problems besides the cameras. Tell us what else you complained about that you felt was putting patients in jeopardy at the hospital.
Well, the lack of stocking of emergency drugs, the lack of stocking of our anesthesia epidural carts, but the main dangers to patient safety occurred with the severe understaffing that was occurring in the women's center during my last couple years there particularly.
Now, that overlapped with the nurses' strike, the nurses' walkout, did it not, where they were alleging essentially the same thing? They were saying the hospital wasn't paying enough to retain quality nurses and that therefore they were going to competitive facilities and that there was a shortage. Was that essentially your observation or the same kind of thing that you were concerned about?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We had something like 21 experienced nurses leave Grossman Hospital Women's Center Labor and Delivery for other hospitals, and that not only does that leave you short-staffed, but it also leaves an experience deficit, because what they would do is they'd bring in new grads, and these new grads right out of nursing school were mm-hmm. perky and full of energy and hardworking, but there is no substitute for experience.
Yeah.
When you have a bad fetal strip, or you're questioning whether a fetal heart rate is bad at 2 a.m, there's no substitute for experience. And this isn't news. I mean, nurses were on, hundreds of them were on bridges and in the streets with signs saying,
yeah,
this is the real Sharp experience, no more than a couple months ago.
Yeah. And I do want to interject here. Sharp is not here. We have asked them for comment on this. We certainly invite them. If they're willing to come on the show, we'll give them equal time. I don't want to make it sound like the hospital is all bad. In fact, just within the last month, they did win an award as one of America's best hospitals for heart care by the Women's Choice Award. They're in the top 9% of hospitals for health care services, according to that. They've certainly won others, magnet-designated hospital, among other things. But that said, these are certainly very serious allegations. So as of when you left, had any of these situations improved?
Not at the time I left.
And that was when?
That was on January 15th, 2016.
Now let's talk about what led up to you finally leaving. The hospital has, you know, in their response to this suit, one of their things they're saying is that you left voluntarily, that you were not pressured to leave, but you've said that you were. Can you explain?
They made it very uncomfortable to work there by spreading rumors that I was rough with patients and that I was mean to the nurses and that I pushed the nurses too hard, when in reality all I was doing was trying to make the Women's Center a better place and have them adhere to the dictates of the OBGYN Supervisory Committee, which dictates the care in the Women's Center.
Had they pressured you about any of this stuff before you became this whistleblower talking about these cameras?
No, I was much in tune with everybody there for most of my time there. It was like a second family, Miriam.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You know, I mean, I didn't even mind taking Thanksgiving call there. I would take every Thanksgiving because it was like being there with family.
Yeah.
And that all changed.
So very dedicated doctor, it sounds like. So you've told us that they also started stripping you off of some of the key committees that you were on.
Yeah, that was one of the last straws, because when you go to the anesthesia I was a member of the Anesthesia Supervisory Committee since 1994, and the anesthesia representative to the Women's Center and member of the OBGYN Supervisory Committee since 1997. And those are the committees where you bring issues that need to be fixed. It's where policies and decisions are made about these things. And so if you take me off those committees, you're effectively silencing me.
What reason did they give for removing you off the committees?
They told me, the chief of staff told me that we have a new CEO that is reaching out to the medical staff, and we want doctors on these committees who are more collegial and less confrontational.
Do you believe that this was really about trying to pressure you into just resigning so that they would be getting rid of a whistleblower?
Well, absolutely. Because when you make complaints or suggest process improvement items and those things aren't fixed, it was to silence me.
So in your lawsuit, obviously, you know, you're asking, I'm sure, for money, for damages, for what's happened to you. Have you been able to find other work since you left the hospital?
Well, just some sporadic work at an outpatient surgery center, nothing even close to the full-time work that I had enjoyed at Grossmont Hospital.
If you prevail in your lawsuit, what do you hope will come out of it? What do you hope to achieve?
Well, I hope that the hospital learns that you can't treat their doctors and nurses this way, that you cannot silence health professionals who are bringing up patient safety issues. My primary motivation for this lawsuit is for the people of East County and the patients of East County who deserve better care than they're getting. And it's also for the nurses, doctors, and techs who are still working in that toxic culture that still exists there. In other words, I want justice. I mean, we don't have any proof that the cameras were rolling in 2016, but the analogy I would give you, Miriam, is say somebody breaks into your garage and steals your car, and the police catch him. He admits to doing it. He does his time. And then 3 years later, you find the same guy standing outside your garage with a crowbar in one hand at 3 a.m. and a ski mask on. And he says, I wasn't going to break into your garage. Do you believe him?
Good point. So in your, as part of your lawsuit, are you able through discovery process to ask for any videotapes to get any documentation to find out whether or not the videotaping is still going on or was going on when you noticed cameras the second time around in January of 2016?
My understanding is that we are going to ask the judge to allow us to do exactly that, to do forensic examination of some of these monitors and computers to see if that was indeed occurring.
Okay, thank you. I'll let you have the last word here today, Dr. Sullivan. What else would you like to say to our listeners here, many of whom may have been patients at one time at Sharp Grossmont Hospital?
What I'm trying to get with this lawsuit is justice, and to the many East County patients and families that I've gotten to know time and time again over the years, because, Miriam, many of them would come in for subsequent births, and you'd get to see the kids grow up, and it was just a wonderful thing. To them, I would say there are very, very many excellent nurses and doctors that are still at Grossmont Hospital, and that your experience and these experiences that you see where people have wonderful outcomes, they're still happening, but they're happening because of the individual efforts of the doctors, nurses, and techs that are still working there, overcoming these obstacles and overcoming this toxic environment that exists there.
Okay. We've been speaking with Dr. Patrick Sullivan, longtime anesthesiologist and former head of anesthesiology, about his lawsuit against Sharp Grossmont Hospital here in La Mesa. Well, we certainly appreciate you coming on the show, Dr. Sullivan, and speaking out on these very important issues, and we'll be staying on top of it, and listeners will certainly be providing you updates as the case works its way through the court and we hear more. And if we do hear back from the hospital, then we'll certainly be presenting more of their side of the story. Well, we want to thank you very much, Dr. Sullivan, for taking the time to come on our show today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you, Miriam.
Welcome to Destination East County with your hosts, Rebecca Williamson
and Jonathan Getz, bringing you the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County
each week. This week's Destination East County includes Latin music at a winery, a gardening with nature program, and all that jazz salute to local heroes, a star NFL quarterback coming to East County in a stage production of To Kill a Mockingbird.
Plus, we'll tell you about coming attractions, including Karamu, a Black History Month celebration in Spring Valley, more Black History events at local colleges, Jungle Book for kids, a Queen Bee Tea in Alpine, internationally acclaimed Gregory Page performing at Mission Trails, a healthy living fair for seniors, the annual Run East County St. Patrick's Day Half Marathon, plus carnival rides and more at the Rolando Street Fair.
So stay tuned for all of these events and many more.
Pickwick Players will present To Kill a Mockingbird from February 17th through the 26th at Off-Broadway Live in Santee. Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Harper Lee, To Kill a Mockingbird is the timeless and timely story of attorney Atticus Finch and his children in the summer of 1935 in Maycomb, Alabama, while defending a black man accused of assaulting a white woman. This coming-of-age story of prejudice and violence, tolerance and community is as relevant today as it was when it was first published in 1960. For tickets and details, visit pickwickplayers.net.
Composer and guitarist Ruben DeLago will perform classical Spanish, Latin, and popular guitar music on February 18th from 7 to 10 p.m. at the San Pascual Winery Tasting Room in downtown La Mesa. Wines by the glass, cheese, crackers, and desserts are available. For details, visit sanpascualwinery.com.
Gardening with nature, birds and butterflies and bats and bees will be the topic discussed by gardening expert Connie Beck at the La Mesa Beautiful Annual Meeting on February 19th at 4 p.m. The event will be held in the Nan Couts Cottage near the La Mesa Community Center. The event is open to the public and refreshments will be served. Beck has been an organic gardening instructor and landscape designer for the past 30 years. She's also been a canyoneer and a nature interpreter for the Audubon Society and a volunteer with National Wildlife Federation, creating backyard habitats for wildlife. Currently, she works with the California Native Plant Society. She has also previously hosted the Ready, Set, Grow segment on East County Magazine's radio show. Her talk will teach you how to choose beautiful native plants and make design choices to save water and create sustainable landscapes in your garden. To RSVP and get more information, visit lamesabeautiful.org.
You're invited to don your Great Gatsby glam or cocktail attire for All That Jazz, the La Mesa Chamber of Commerce's 9th annual Salute to Local Heroes. This year's event will be held on Wednesday, February 22nd from 5 to 8 p.m. at the Town and Country Resort and Convention Center's Golden Ballroom in Mission Valley. The Chamber will award local heroes from the La Mesa Police Department, Fire Department, paramedics, and retired police department volunteers. This evening will also serve to install the Chamber's new board of directors and officers. This evening includes dinner plus prize drawings and a silent auction while celebrating those who help make our community safe and meeting the Chamber's new business leaders. For tickets, you can visit lamesachamber.com.
In honor of Black History Month, Marlon Briscoe, the first starting African-American quarterback in the NFL, will be speaking at Grossmont College on his greatest lesson in life, persistence. Briscoe played for the Denver Broncos and also became the runner-up for Rookie of the Year. The event will be held in Griffin Gate from 12:30 to 2:30 p.m. For a complete list of all Black History Month events at the Grossmont Cuyamaca Community College District, visit gccd.edu.
Now for a preview of coming attractions.
Karamu, a celebration of Black History Month, will be held February 25th from 1 to 3 p.m. at the County Library in Spring Valley at 836 Kempton Street from 1 to 3 p.m. This event will include speakers, art, live entertainment, children's activities, and refreshments. For details, visit the San Diego County Library site at sdcl.org.
Black History Month also includes a showing of The Birth of a Nation at Cuyamaca College's Digital Theater on Monday, February 27th from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. This film is based on the story of Nat Turner, who led a slave rebellion in Virginia in 1831. For a full list of events at Grossmont and Cuyamaca Colleges, visit gccd.edu/news.
Young Adult Theater brings The Jungle Book for Kids to life March 2nd through the 12th at the Encore Theater in Spring Valley. The jungle is jumpin' with a jazzy beat in this special adaptation from the classic Disney animated film, featuring a host of colorful characters and your favorite songs from the movie. Banished by the ferocious tiger Shere Khan, the boy Mowgli and his panther friend Bagheera are on the run in the deepest parts of the jungle. On their journey, the two meet a sinister snake, a herd of elephants, and a giant bear named Baloo, who teaches them the swingin' musical rhythms of the jungle. After surviving a dangerous encounter with a band of monkeys, Mowgli and Bagheera must rally the jungle animals into a battle to restore peace throughout the jungle. For tickets and details, visit Young Adult Theater's website at yatsandiego.org.
Now here's the buzz. Alpine Mountain Empire Chamber of Commerce invites you to the Queen Bee Tea on March 5th at 11:30 in the Alpine Community Center. Tea time will be presented by Donna Marie's Tea, plus guests will enjoy vendors and a fashion show by Dana's Boutique. You could be chosen Queen Bee in the Bee Bonnet Hat Contest. The Queen Bee Tea also marks the beginning of honey season in Alpine, to be crowned by the first annual Honey Festival coming up later in March. For tickets and details on the Queen Bee Tea March 5th, you can visit alpinechamber.com and click on Events.
Gregory Page will perform in the Visitor Center Concert Hall at Mission Trails Regional Park on March 5th at 3 p.m. The concert will include selections from his brand new, soon-to-be-released album, So It Goes, as well as other classics from the extensive Gregory Page songbook. Page is a critically acclaimed recording and international touring artist whose original music is nostalgic, cinematic, and charming in its ability to have audiences rewind to the early 20th century through his guitar and vocal performances. For more information, you can visit Mission Trails Regional Park's website at mtrp.org.
This year's Run East County St. Patrick's Day Half Marathon will be held early on Sunday, March 5th. Wear green if you join in this fun and festive event, which includes not only the half marathon, but also a 5K run walk, a green mile, and a tribes and clans competition to involve the whole family in fun and fitness. The event is organized by the Run East County Foundation to raise funds benefiting several East County charities. To enter or volunteer, you can visit stpatricksdayhalf.com.
You're invited to Spring into Healthy Living on March 15th from 9 a.m. to 12 noon at the McGrath Family YMCA in Spring Valley. The health and wellness fair for seniors will include free health screenings, speakers, and information on how to avoid scams, driver safety, and fire safety, and more. Health screenings will include blood pressure, balance, body mass index, a hearing test, stroke screening, check your mood, and more. You can also learn about senior-friendly exercise demonstrations, senior resources, and enjoy a healthy continental breakfast. The Healthy Living event is organized by the AARP, East County Chamber of Commerce, and Grossmont Healthcare District. For details and breakfast reservations, you can call 877-926-8300 or visit the East County Chamber's website at business.eastcountychamber.org and click on their calendar.
A star party will be held at the Sycamore Gooden Reserve in Lakeside on March 17th from 6 to 8 p.m. You're invited to join volunteer astronomers from the San Diego Astronomy Association and county park staff for a night under the stars, viewing our galaxy using the same technology used by professionals to witness out-of-this-world phenomena. Inclement weather could cancel this event. For more information, you can call 858-513-4737.
On Sunday, March 26th, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., the 21st annual Rolando Street Fair will be held on Rolando Boulevard, south of El Cajon Boulevard. The event includes over 130 vendors with handcrafts, food, carnival rides, and kids' activities. Live music bands will include Len Rainey and the Midnight Players, Trey Tosh and the band called Life, The Routine, Paul Cannon, Iron Sagewood, and Cassidy and the Music. Nearly 15,000 people attend this family-friendly event each year. That's all for this week. If you have an event you'd like added to our calendar, or if you would like to sponsor the Destination East County column on our website, or the Destination East County show on KNSJ Radio, you can contact editor at eastcountymagazine.org. Destination East County is the most read feature on our website.
We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, attractions in San Diego's East County. See you around, East County.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Liz Alper, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor at eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.